listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain.
This is
Sparta, Part 4, The Tale of Epaminondas. The 2006 movie 300 was very popular and influential with young men, and especially young martial artists. I've spent the last three episodes of this podcast outlining various reasons why the film is misleading, and especially why ancient Sparta and the Spartans were not worth emulating. Today I want to tell you about an ancient Greek man who, in my opinion, was much worthier of admiration. A bit more than 50 years after the events so poorly depicted in the film, a boy was born into an impoverished family of noble ancestry in a Greek city which has yet to be mentioned in a significant way in our story. That city's name was Thebes, and the boy's name was Epaminondas. He was quiet and thoughtful as a young boy, and spent most of his time hanging around an aged philosopher named Lysis. While other children were busy playing, Epaminondas was pestering old Lysis with questions about everything. Yes, Epaminondas was an ancient Greek nerd. Despite being a studious lad, he was also fascinated by everything martial. He learned everything he could about how to become a better athlete and warrior. He studied and practiced exercise techniques to develop his agility. He practiced constantly with weapons. In his own way, Epaminondas was a bit like me and many of you who listen to this podcast. He started life as an awkward and bookish weakling, and then trained in the martial arts in order to remake himself. Unlike many young boys in Sparta, who had no other option, Epaminondas chose a martial life of his own volition. He also obsessed over the study of military strategy, tactics, and history. As his growth into a man and a warrior progressed, his home city of Thebes was enmeshed in a series of wars with Sparta. Also in that time, the government of Thebes changed from an oligarchy to a democracy. Democracy then spread out from Thebes until the entire area of Greece around it, Boeotia, was a united political entity. At the same time, Theban generals were learning from their Spartan enemies. Leading the way among them was Epaminondas, who had risen to become a general himself in the Theban army. He had learned a great deal about Greek heavy infantry, or hoplite, warfare. He had studied the battles and the generals of history. Just as, more than two millennia later, Bruce Lee would draw from a variety of martial arts styles in an attempt to develop a new approach, so Epaminondas borrowed from earlier military thinkers to help perfect a better, more modern style of warfighting. By Epaminondas's time, hoplite warfare had become hidebound in tradition and custom, just as the martial arts had become by Bruce Lee's time. One custom was to always put your best troops on the right end of your battle line. This was to prevent the drift to the right that was common in hoplite formations. You see, each soldier in a phalanx depended on the shield of the man to his right to protect his right side. If the man to your right, for whatever reason, moved away from you to his right, you were suddenly partially exposed. The reflexive response was to step to the right yourself to once more shelter behind your neighbor's shield. But that in turn exposed the man to your left, who, in turn, would step to the right, which, in turn, exposed yet another hoplite to danger, and so on. Do you see where this is going? If any one hoplite steps to the right, every hoplite to his left will now seek to step to the right. This resulted in a situation in which, when a phalanx of heavy infantry marched across the battlefield, It was prone to follow a lurchingly diagonal path forward and to the right, like a drunkard failing to walk in a straight line. This drove Greek generals crazy. After all, you need your troops to go where you want them to go. One customary answer to this problem was to place your best soldiers on the right end of the battle line. Their superior discipline helped to significantly reduce the drift to the right. This placement of the best hoplites on the right became military doctrine. In other words, a tradition not to be lightly altered. This meant that in every infantry battle, your best troops tended to face the opponent's, shall we say, scrubs on their left, while your second string faced the enemy's best troops. The Spartans loved this tradition. You see, one major ongoing problem for the Spartan military was a manpower shortage. This is the price they paid for their cruel social structure. The elite Spartiate class from which their soldiers was drawn was only a very small fraction of the population. The brutal attrition of the Spartan military education process, the agoge, didn't help the manpower shortage either. The Spartans virtually never fielded an army made up entirely of Spartiate soldiers. There simply weren't enough of them. Instead, the elite Spartans manned the right end of the battle line, as was the custom, while the rest of the line would be manned by the troops of city-states allied with Sparta, or, even more frequently, by troops of subject city-states Sparta had conquered, or even by armed Helot slaves. This means that Spartan heavy infantry, the best in the business, consistently faced troops on the enemy's left that were decidedly not the best. In the years leading up to Epaminondas's time, a few imaginative generals tried reversing tradition and placing their best troops on the left end of the line, but only in a few relatively small engagements and with varying results. Epaminondas would have seen this in his studies and stored it away for future use. Another aspect of hoplite warfare, one that varied from city to city, was the number of rows of hoplites that made up a phalanx. The fewer the rows of spearmen, the wider the area of the battlefield that your front row could cover, but the less power you had pushing your front row from behind, and the fewer replacements you had for casualties in the front row. How to manage this mix was an ongoing subject of debate among Greek military minds. The Spartans tended to keep their phalanx about 8 to 12 rows deep, which would also have been something Epaminondas would have known, and also that other city-states used different formulas. Yet another tradition of hoplite warfare was to use heavy infantry almost exclusively, mostly choosing not to use cavalry or missile troops to any great extent. Again, a few imaginative Greek generals in earlier decades had begun to experiment with a greater role for cavalry on the battlefield. You see, heavy infantry armed with long spears tends to be vulnerable on the flanks. When soldiers are packed into a phalanx and then attacked on their flank, bad things happen very quickly. It takes a lot of time, training, and discipline to learn to get all those spears pointed in another direction without confusion and panic setting in. Well, when it comes to attacking the flanks, you need troops that can move fast. And cavalry is just what the general ordered. The city of Thebes had developed an effective cavalry force in recent years, giving Epaminondas yet another weapon to wield. Sparta had also begun to use cavalry, but compared to Thebes, in this particular area of military science, they were well behind the curve. One more unit of the Theban army that had recently been developed was the legendary Sacred Band. The Sacred Band was a group of 300 heavy infantry that training and combat had honed into a cadre of hard-assed veterans, a professional unit equal to or better than any equal number of Spartans. The wars between Sparta and Thebes were still ongoing, so when Epaminondas decided he was ready, he gathered his troops to meet a large Spartan force at the plains of Leuctra near Thebes. Before the battle, the other Theban generals were reluctant to confront the Spartans. The Spartan army, the legendary high-quality Spartan army outnumbered the Theban army almost 2-1. But Epaminondas was able to convince them that he had a plan that would work. Of the 11,000 men in the Spartan army, only about 700 to 1,000 of them were elite Spartans. Now, in the past, other Greek armies and generals would avoid set-piece battles with the Spartans altogether, or failing that, fight in such a way so as to minimize contact with the Spartan part of the enemy front line, or at least to minimize the damage that the Spartans could do to their best troops. Epaminondas had something entirely different in mind. He was going to go directly after the best soldiers in the Spartan army, the Spartiates. Right off the bat, he violated tradition and put his best troops, led by the sacred band, on the left end of his line, directly across from the elite Spartiates. He further strengthened the left end of his line by making it 50 rows of hoplites deep. Yes, you heard right, 50. The only way he could swing this, as outnumbered as he was to leave the right end of his line extremely thin, only a few rows deep. To the eyes of a tradition-bound Greek general, this formation would have seemed like the work of a madman. But Epaminondas was crazy like a fox. The battle began with both sides sending out their cavalry. The superior Theban cavalry made short work of the Spartan horse soldiers, driving the survivors back into the ranks of the elite Spartan hoplites on the right end of the line. Few things disrupt a formation of heavy infantry, no matter how disciplined, even the vaunted Spartiates, more than dozens of horses crashing into them all at once. Meanwhile, the left wing of the Theban army was crossing the battlefield and charging the Spartan front line at double time. Think of a cohesive body of thousands of veteran hoplites, each one lugging half his body weight in weapons and armor, gaining speed into a jogging run. Added together, that's a huge amount of momentum. Just as the Spartiate infantry was reorganizing, trying to reform its ranks and columns, the front rank of the Theban steamroller, the elite sacred band, crashed into them like 300 bronze hammers. Meanwhile, the thin right end of the Theban line formed a diagonal, covering the right flank of the massive left end of the line, and angling away from the Spartans. None of the hoplites in this diagonal line tried to engage the enemy. Shortly after the sacred band smashed into the Spartans, the remaining ranks of this massive formation followed them in, continuing and increasing the chaos among the Spartans. The Spartan king and general, Cleombrotus, was almost immediately mortally wounded. Many other senior Spartan officers fell quickly as well. Meanwhile, on the initially weaker Spartan left wing, the lower quality troops there were probably happy not to be fighting the enemy's best hoplites, as would customarily be the case. As a matter of fact, since the skeletally thin Theban right wing had actually backed up to form a screen covering the left wing's flank, they weren't fighting anyone at all. They were probably craning their necks to see what was happening to their right. Those who could see were being treated to a sight heretofore unseen on planet Earth. Lots of elite Spartan hoplites being killed by non-Spartan heavy infantry. Imagine their reaction to this. Holy shit, are you seeing what I'm seeing? Imagine their second reaction when the remaining Spartans began to break formation and flee the battlefield. Holy shit, we're next! Needless to say, they too broke and ran. Epaminondas had done the impossible. He had utterly routed a Spartan army that outnumbered him 2-1. Fully half of the elite Spartiate infantry lay dead, along with more than 500 allied troops. About 300 of the Theban host had died. By going right after the strength of the Spartan line with overwhelming force, Epaminondas had broken all the rules of hoplite warfare, and in the process, drastically altered the course of Greek history. As a matter of fact, when he used part of his army in diagonal echelon formation to guard his flank, he invented a tactic that is still taught in military academies to this day, It's called Refusing the Flank. The Battle of Leuctra was the beginning of the end of Spartan military supremacy in Greece. But Epaminondas was not done. He later invaded Spartan territory and liberated the Helot slaves. Not only that, he shepherded the freed Helots to their original home city, Messenia, and helped them rebuild it, better than ever. Messenia now had some of the strongest fortifications anywhere in Greece, and would act as a bulwark against possible Spartan resurgence. So, what do you think of Epaminondas? This nerdy kid from Thebes had built himself into a formidable warrior, and then into a brilliant general. He broke the back of the vaunted Spartan military, freed their slaves, and then set them up in a fortified city. Now that's what I call a role model. But, for you homophobes out there, Epaminondas cannot be your role model. That's right. Epaminondas was gay. And guess what? So was the elite Sacred Band. Every last one of them. The Sacred Band was made up entirely of 150 pairs of homosexual partners. That's right. The uber-macho, proto-Nazi bullies of Sparta got their asses totally kicked by a gay nerd and his gay friends. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, and check out old episodes of The Martial Brain at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.